Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. Today I have a very special guest, and I'm honored that he is taking time to come on the show. This is Mr. Joseph Meyer. He's the president of Meyer & Associates and the founder and president of Straight Money Analysis, which is his financial newsletter. And people should go to straightmoneyanalysis.com and start educating yourself. I wanted our theme this year to be some, you know, more about what we can do to help ourselves. We know there's a problem out there with the medical system. And I'm sure everybody's been watching the news and all these statistics that have come out about our economy. But for me, it doesn't seem to jibe. It's like a cognitive dissonance. They're telling us how awesome it is. We have, you know, basically zero jobless rate. Everybody's happy. But I'm not seeing that on the ground. And I wanted somebody who was nonpartisan, who knows this system in and out, who's worked in it for over five decades and is an expert, to come on and answer some questions that personally I have and friends have about what's going on in our society. And I thought the best person to do that would be Mr. Meyer. So, Mr. Meyer, I want to thank you so much for coming on. I can't tell you how happy that you're on my show.
Good morning, Elena. Thank you and Medicine on Call for having me as your guest this morning. It's a pleasure to visit with you and your listening audience. Thank you, Elena.
Oh, you're so welcome. Look, let's get started. I mean, we're a nonpartisan show. We talk about the facts and what's best from a critical thinking perspective. And there's been a lot of rhetoric about free trade agreements. I've read some of the TPP stuff, and I'm just appalled by it. But on, you know, over the overview, what is the deal with these free market treaties? And they don't seem to be helping the United States. So if you can give us a little bit of a take on what you think about NAFTA and TPP, et cetera.
Well, these trade agreements, as you know, have been going on for many decades, and they're basically very unfair. And they continue to take the jobs out of working class America, and we continue to see the economies of the world affected by them. It's going to take many, many years, I believe, to reverse the policies that have been put into place, and it's going to be very painful as we go through what needs to be done to correct these problems.
Were they set up that to put America at a disadvantage? I mean, who's standing to gain? Is it the developing countries? Is it corporations? Or is it really the individual?
Well, I think we have to put into perspective these trade agreements have been part and parcel of trying to secure the cheapest worldwide labor at any cost, and they've succeeded in doing that. We've continued to see the cheapest worldwide labor move throughout the various different countries of the world, and this is something, again, that's been very unfair, and it's been a very uneven playing field.
It certainly seems that way. It's as if our standard of living in our system has dropped to the national, or I should say the international standard. I saw this kind of under, you know, maybe about 20 years ago when we started talking about globalism and how we needed to, you know, bring everybody in the world up to our standard, but it seems it's been the opposite effect.
Well, I think that statement is very true and very accurate, and I think simply we couldn't bring the rest of the world up to our standards, so we brought our standards down to the level of the rest of the world. That's the way I see it.
Me too. And, you know, when you think about the movement, the migration patterns, especially from the Middle East into the Western societies, especially in the United States right now, is that really what's going on with this? It's a cheap labor. It's not really about humanitarianism. Is it about cheap labor?
It's about cheap labor, and Elena, it's also about massive profits. And I think those two things go hand in hand, and people fail to recognize that fact.
So these profits are corporate profits, I assume you're talking about?
Yes.
And this is actually a separate question. I'm not sure you can answer it, but in your opinion, how did the corporate interest become so powerful that they could override sovereignty?
Well, I think, again, you have to go back. You have to understand history. You have to understand what this country has been put through and what continues to this day as we speak. You know, we started to see the changes in America start in the late 1960s and through the 70s and 80s, and we put into motion a priority where corporate interests certainly overtook the interests of the average American and certainly, more importantly, working-class America. And it's taken many, many decades to wind up where we currently are. But I think when we talk of the bigger picture, we currently have about 48% of Americans below the age of 30 that now rightly believe the American dream is dead. I don't believe for a minute the American dream is dead, Elena, but I do believe it's been very badly wounded.
Is there anything we can do to reverse this?
Well, I think we can reverse it. I think we have to get back to the basics of what made this country at one time very great. We have to be able to allow people to earn a meaningful living, to educate their children, and certainly prepare for the things that are ahead of us in all of our lives. And more importantly, we have to look towards the goals and the principles, again, that made this country great, and we have to get back to what once worked and get away from what's not working. I think that's simply what needs to be said.
So, you know, if I'm a small business owner, and from my perspective, the small business owners are the ones that are going to be able to do what you just described. I can't see corporate interests at this point giving up their bottom line to increase pay scales and improve, working conditions from a salary standpoint. We don't really have competition, it looks like. I mean, from a health perspective, what I've seen is, you can answer the question from a business perspective, but monopolies have come online where it's too big to fail. There's huge hospital systems. There's only a few transnational insurance companies, and there's not a lot of choice. And the private market, doctors, independent, health-related services have been pushed out, put out of business, or bought out. How can, from a business perspective, am I on the right track, or is that something, do you think small business is really the answer here to break this cycle?
Well, I think you're on the right track, and more importantly, as you know, small business has played a very integral part of what we've witnessed in the growth area of this economy over many, many decades. 90% of the businesses created in America, as you know, are small businesses, and they've never been under more stress and more pressure than we've witnessed over the last two decades. We have to get back again to what's worked, and we have to get away from what has not. The changes are going to be painful, but they have to be made, because if we're going to have a future in America, we just cannot continue down this road. I just don't see us continuing.
Well, be more specific if you can. What has worked? What is the things that we've gotten away from that we need to get back to?
Well, I think we have to get back to when honesty, integrity, and the truth truly matter, and we have to get back to, again, the things that once made America great, and we have to get away from this mentality of, there's something for nothing out in the marketplace, and we'll continue to seek out the cheapest worldwide labor, and we'll continue to sell the cheapest made products. We once made the greatest products in the world, and we can once again make them. It's just a commitment of corporate America to bring these jobs back from overseas and build the plants and equip them in America and retrain the people here so they can work in these plants and once again earn a meaningful living. That's the way I see it.
So those politicians who've said manufacturing is gone, never to come back, get used to the new normal, that really is a load. That's basically a load of bunk, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
So from our tax perspective, the way it's set up, the structure of it, I mean, I'm paying double taxes as a small business owner. You know, I don't really have enough capital to expand because I'm just paying taxes 24/7. And I've read statistics that 47%, about less than half the country, are not paying taxes at all. Is that actually true?
Well, I think we've got a lot of people not paying taxes. I think when you talk about unemployment, we certainly have far more people unemployed than anyone wants to admit. We have the labor participation rate, as you know, back down to the levels we once saw in the 1960s. So this is telling us that people have dropped out of the workforce. They're not interested in certainly working these low-paying jobs. 60% of all new jobs created since the last recession are entry-level positions paying less than $13 an hour. We also have major retailers now closing stores at an alarming rate. Consumers, again, as you know, Elena, are now over $11 trillion in debt. 50% of all student loans at 347 universities and vocational schools are now in default. Small business ownership now at the lowest level has ever been recorded. Since 2008, our national debt has increased by $9 trillion. And again, as you know, Elena, in 1980, our national debt totaled just $1 trillion. We have a $19 trillion national debt. So it's going to take many, many things. I think it's going to take a number of years to turn the situation around. Quite frankly, I don't think it's going to be easy. I really don't.
So I want to tease apart what you just said, because this is two diametrically opposed positions if you're looking at the two parties running right now.
Yes.
You know, and we've done the Keynesian thing of, you know, giving money to the government so we can dole it out to everybody, which is, it makes absolutely no sense to me. But what is Keynesian politics, in your opinion? To me, it's just a giveaway to the government, but I'm not a professional. So if you can just tell my listeners what that really means, since it's what we've been doing, isn't it, for the past, 8 years at least?
Well, you know, we were supposed to see supply-side economics. We were supposed to see, as we've been told many times, the trickle-down theory. We have not seen the wealth trickle down as we were led to believe it would. We've seen money go into Wall Street and go into the banks, and it has not found its way into the pockets of the average American. I think this is why we have the socioeconomic problems we're facing in this country today. We now have 56% of all Americans that now have subprime credit. The purported economic recovery, and I've called it an illusion from day one, will go down in the history books as the weakest economic recovery since the ending of the Civil War in 1865. Economic prosperity is a statistical illusion, and I believe it's a cruel joke for many Americans. I can't say it any straighter than that.
Who started it? Was it corporate? Was it government? How did we get on the slippery slope from having an economy that created something, you know, material-wise, from a manufacturer standpoint, to nothing? I mean, I remember back, in the 80s, when we had all this internet boom and all these companies that didn't make anything being overvalued.
Very true.
I mean, how do we get to this farce that they want to call an economy? Because there's nothing of material that's made.
Well, because we've built bubbles within the economy. We had a dot-com bubble. We had a housing bubble. We had a stock market bubble. But when you take a look at the bubbles, yes, they created initially some jobs, but they were not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there isn't an industry in America that can even begin to put back the massive amount of people that are now unemployed. Did you know, as a physician, that suicide has now actively surpassed car accidents as the number one cause of injury or death in the United States? You know that, Lena?
Wow, no, I didn't know that, and that's frightening. That means the hope is gone for most people, even though they're trying to tell us everything's awesome.
I think for most people, quite honestly, they've given up a long time ago.
So when we get these statistics, and I know that they're kind of pieced together, when they tell you that the unemployment rate is, 6% or whatever it is, what do you think the effect of the real unemployment rate is? Because I know they stopped counting people who no longer look for work.
I think if we go back and we use the measurement of unemployment that we had used as a yardstick going back to the 1950s, the true unemployment rate, Elaine, is probably well over 20%.
Wow. On that note,
that's what I believe.
That's really sad. And on that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today we're having a conversation about economics, a real conversation, not what they want you to believe, but what actually is. Because I firmly believe that you can't make a conscious decision unless you know all the facts. It's hard to find them, frankly. You really have to go and do your own due diligence, because if you stick to what you're being told, you would just think everything's great. And Mr. Joseph Meyer is my guest today, and we're talking about the structure of our economy and how we got here. And people should go to his website, straightmoneyanalysis.com. He writes a newsletter, which just came out this like a week ago. And this is the first level of being educated. Now, I know, Mr. Meyer, before the break, we were talking a lot of overview. But, you know, again, I want to go tease apart what's been said in the media. Ron Paul, when he ran, talked a lot about auditing the Federal Reserve. But I'm not sure people really know what that is. Can you give us a little brief history, if you can, of what is the Fed and how did it become so powerful?
Well, simply, the Federal Reserve System is the central bank of the United States. It regulates the U.S. monetary and financial systems. The Federal Reserve is comprised of a central governmental agency in Washington, D.C., as you know, Elena. Board of Governors has 12 regional Federal Reserve banks in major cities throughout the United States, and it regulates, as I said earlier, monetary and financial systems. That's what the Federal Reserve is.
Well, the way the Constitution is set up, doesn't Congress actually have the power of the purse and the power to create money?
Yes, they do.
And they've abrogated that to the Federal Reserve. That's my take on it. So we're actually spending money we're paying them to create money, which makes no sense. So technically, that is the beginning, in my opinion, and I could be wrong, you know, correct me, of our government outsourcing itself to another entity. That's not us, right?
No, it's not.
So we're really, overall, if you really think about it, at the whim of an unelected body. And who are these people? Who elects them? Where do they come from?
Well, these people are elected by the Board of Governors of the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks in the United States. That's the answer to that.
So there's no Americans associated or voting or knowing who these guys are and what their motivations are. Technically,
they're appointed within the system of the Federal Reserve.
So when they start messing around with interest rates and raising and lowering them, how does that really affect us as individuals in the country?
Well, you know, we have the lowest interest rates since the Depression of the 1930s. And I think when you look at low interest rates and you look at the ability of the economy to certainly have benefited from the massive amount of liquidity that's been pumped into the system, it's been a failure. But I think when you look more importantly globally and you look at all the central banks of the world and you look at them all pumping simultaneously massive amounts of capital into the global economies, and you take a look at the slowdowns that we've had in Japan, certainly the slowdown we've witnessed in China recently, and more importantly, the ever-growing economy of India as well. The massive amount of liquidity that's been pumped by all these central banks of the world have failed, I believe, to bring the economies of these countries back to their prior state.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe the massive amount of liquidity pumped into the system has been able to accomplish what these central banks of the world truly believed it would.
And so when they're talking about now to try to juice the economy again with negative interest rates, what does that actually mean?
Well, I think, again, when you talk about the negative interest rate policies we've witnessed in countries similarly, Japan, Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, as you know, the ECB bank for 18 nations that used the euro was using negative interest rates as well.
Mm-hmm.
what it basically means is you pay the bank to hold your money, that you don't draw any interest on your money, that the rate of inflation is higher than a rate of interest, which is negative, being paid on your savings and or deposits in the bank. That's what it means, Elena.
So it's costing you to put your money in the bank. They're taking your money. Now, let's revisit, if we can, when we did the major bailout.
Okay.
Is there... how am I going to ask this question? Was it a wise move to give money to the banking system with the, I think the caveat was they're supposed to be more loose with their lending. What was the reason that we did that, and what were we supposed to get from it?
Well, as you know, the reason was to save the troubled banks and save the banking system. And initially we were told $800 billion would turn the situation around. Mm-hmm. And as we know, $4 trillion later, a lot of these banks are still in the same difficulty they were before. The money never found its way into the small businesses that were certainly starving for cash at the time that banking crisis began in 2008. And as you know, we had a stock market that topped out at 14,100 and bottomed in March of 2008 at 6,470. And since we've seen quantitative easing 1, 2, 3, and possibly maybe even quantitative easing number 4 down the road at some point, the market went from 6,470 to recently around 18,500. So the money went into the banks, went into the corporations that, instead of certainly putting it back into the economy, turned around, bought their own stock, and drove the market to what I think is unrealistic valuations. That's exactly what in my mind took place, and that's what I think people fail to realize and want to understand.
What is, if you could make policy, what would you do to try to reverse that? How could you make it give them less incentive to hoard?
Well, I think, banks have to be compelled to lend once again to the credit worthy. I think there's many businesses, as you alluded to, that are starving for capital, that would like to expand and certainly are able to do so if financing is put in place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to see money work its way back through the system the way it always has in the past, and work its way into small businesses that'll put it back into the community by hiring people and allowing them to certainly support the small businesses and allowing them to grow. It's a very simple concept if you sit down and you think about it for a minute. It worked in the past, and it will work again. We just have to get back again, as I said, to the basics.
And I think from the corporate standpoint, not stop being so greedy about things. I mean, we've seen, at least from my perspective, this has been a commingling or hooking up of what's going on economically and social justice, whatever they want to call it. The rhetoric doesn't really jibe with what's going on. And there's been a real demonization of capitalism, as if that's the reason that this happened. But is this capitalism, or is this cronyism or fascism, where the government and the corporate interest have aligned and they're working together to keep it going?
I think the simple answer to that, Elena, is it's all of them.
Okay. Well, what's the capitalist part of it?
Well, the capitalist part of it is they turn a profit, and that's why they're in business. They don't care.